supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
New Jersey Governor Chris Christie delivered his seventh and final State of the State address today. I'm Dave Heller, and this is NewsWorks Tonight. Let's make sense of Christie's speech with John Reitmeier, budget and finance writer for NJ Spotlight. John, thanks for joining us again on NewsWorks Tonight. The governor started off by saying the state of the state is good, and then he listed a variety of economic factors. Of course, numbers can be parsed in many different ways, but he cites home sales up, unemployment down. He's saying that taxes are cut this year for the first time since 1996. Have you had a chance to take a closer look at the numbers?
Yeah, I have. And, you know, obviously the state of the state is a setting where, you know, the governor traditionally puts as bright a face on things as possible. There were, you know, a few things that were left out. Christie ticked off a list of tax cuts that just went into effect at the start of 2017 as part of the deal with lawmakers to get those tax cuts enacted. New Jersey started a new 23-cent gas tax increase that's been particularly unpopular in November, and there was no mention of the tax hike that many people are feeling when they buy gas, as Christie ticked off that list of tax cuts. On some of the economic numbers, the unemployment rate has dropped significantly since Christie first took office in early 2010. We were in the midst of a recession. It's been more flat over the last 12 months, and New Jersey had a not as good year for job creation in 2016 as it did in 2015. So there's a little more to that telling as well.
Perhaps sensing his vulnerability on the numbers, he quickly shifted and actually spent the bulk of the address on the growing drug problem in the Garden State. Let's listen to him describing the scope of the problem.
This is affecting our education system. Children coming to school high or tortured by a drug culture at home cannot learn. It's affecting the medical community. The cost of this epidemic is putting a burden on our system which we will not be able to bear in the years to come. Police are in danger every day. Citizens are at risk on the streets and on the roads as drug addiction causes behavior that law enforcement simply cannot handle.
John, problem this pervasive that the governor lays out, what were some of the solutions he offered?
So this was actually a very deep in the weeds policy speech when it comes to addiction treatment. He introduced a new hotline and website to serve as sort of a clearinghouse for services. He asked lawmakers to join him in passing a new mandate that those who seek treatment would be guaranteed basically insurance coverage as they're getting those services. He talked about getting more money for treatment beds and allowing older teenagers to qualify for youth treatment beds to kind of fill some that are going unfilled at the younger ages. New limits on the length of opioid prescriptions that doctors would have to abide by. Some school curriculum changes, teaching about addiction as early as in kindergarten. There was talk of the way that the Medicaid expansion portion of the Affordable Care Act has helped the state get more reimbursements for people who are seeking services. It was a really, it was a long speech, and much of it was about the addiction issue, and much of it was very much in the weeds on that topic.
A multifaceted approach, although realistically in terms of what can be done, at least in the short term, was it more window dressing or substance?
Well, there were some policy proposals, and, you know, even the governor's most strident Democratic critics were complimentary that he would devote a lot of attention to this issue. I think some, in speaking to some lawmakers afterward, raised concern that there are other issues that New Jersey should be dealing with in 2017, in addition to the addiction issue. We'll see how quickly. I mean, I think the lobbying effort on behalf of some of the insurance companies maybe will have already started. We'll see how much can really get accomplished. The governor had a few very touching anecdotes that he shared, including a member of his own staff who had developed a heroin addiction and a former law school classmate who ended up dying while facing addiction. So some of the speech was very personal in nature, and sort of pivoted away from some of these policy goals. So we'll see if some of that emotion of the room today can translate into actual new policy, you know, in the next month or two.
And at least at the onset, are Assembly Speaker Vince Prieto and Senate President Steve Sweeney seemingly cooperative toward that end?
Yeah, and I think what they would say, certainly the Assembly Speaker said afterward, that we should look at other issues that might be contributing to New Jersey's rising rates of addiction. And so if you look at things like the healthcare issue in general, poverty in New Jersey, education, the economy. So I think if there was a critique, it was gently one of maybe looking at the issue more holistically than just from the treatment perspective.
Put all this in context of Christie's plummeting popularity ratings, which are at near an all-time low. The primary for his replacement is a mere 6 months out. Is it realistic that he can get at least facets of his agenda completed by then?
Yeah, I think that will be the big thing. And you know, we have to look at it, as you just said. You know, the state, next month, the governor is expected to deliver the next budget address. And, you know, the deadline in New Jersey for a new budget is June 30th. And after June 30th, because it's not only a gubernatorial year in New Jersey, it's also all 120 seats in the legislature will be up for election. The focus will really shift to the election once that budget deadline hits. So all of this is really being condensed into just a few months, and there will be battles coming up on things like education funding and transportation policy that will play out as we also could be having this discussion about enhancing some of the addiction treatment services. So the schedule is going to be tightened, and there's a lot on the plate in addition to just the topic that he wanted to talk about this afternoon.
Thanks, John.
You're welcome.
John Reitmeier, budget and finance writer for NJ Spotlight. In other news, a battle is brewing between the business community and the city of Philadelphia. A bill that is one signature away from becoming law would demand employers not ask job applicants about their salary history. Details from WHYY's Tom McDonald.
It's a little bit of a straw that breaks the camel's back.
Comcast Senior Executive Vice President David Cohen says the business community is upset with the salary history bill approved by council in December.
We're hearing from companies that are thinking about locating, or at least being solicited to locate in the city, of why would we ever come here with what's going on in the city.
City Councilman Bill Greenlee shepherded the bill through and says he's surprised people are complaining after it's been approved and sent to the mayor for his signature.
I think this is a chance to try to deal with wage inequity. And I think it's reasonable to think if you take a person's past salary off the table, given the history that women and minorities are paid less for the same job, that we have a chance of cutting into this inequity, wage inequity issue.
Rob Wunderling of the Greater Philadelphia Chamber of Commerce says coming to the councilman right as the bill is on the mayor's desk is a little late, but they've always been against the bill, even if they didn't physically testify against it at council.
We just are hoping for, at this late date, let's create a little bit more space, a little bit more time for a little bit more analysis to reach the balance.
Mayor Kenney isn't ready to say whether he'll sign the bill.
Doesn't mean I'm not going to sign it, and we'll see what happens.
Councilman Greenlee says he's not taking the bill away from the mayor for reconsideration.
I just don't see it having the injurious effect that they're trying to make it out to be by taking one question away. And again, not ending discussion, not ending negotiations, none of that. Just taking one question away, I think, is a reasonable approach to attempt to deal with this issue.
If the bill becomes law, a court challenge from the business community is a possibility. However, Cohen and Wunderling won't say if they would head to court to challenge it. I'm Tom McDonald, WHYY News.
Philadelphia's Office for Reintegrating Ex-Offenders has a new executive director with a simple overarching vision: make the program more personal, people-centric. As WHYY's Aaron Mosell reports, part of the reform effort has involved consulting those who've actually lived behind bars.
Aaron spent 5 years in prison after being convicted of aggravated assault. After getting out in 2012, he went to RISE, the city's little-known Office of Reintegration Services for ex-offenders. It wasn't a good experience.
it wasn't what I thought it was. You know, like I thought it was job training and then job placement as well. And it was neither of those things.
Aaron, whose last name we're withholding to avoid undermining legal efforts to leave behind his criminal past, also walked away with a bad taste in his mouth because he thought the office lacked a personal touch.
It wasn't about the people, about helping people specifically. I felt like it was more, just like a robot type of thing. The best word I can use to explain it is just like a shell, you know, like it didn't really have any substance.
Joshua, another ex-offender, has also had his share of letdowns in life after prison, especially around finding employment, what's easily the top concern and biggest challenge for people with a record.
You can say, I can send a man any store, any place to try to get a job, but he has a felony. That's automatically a no-no. I know dudes that's very intelligent that can say everything. Once they see the felony, the door is closed.
So Aaron and Joshua are two members of the Reentry Think Tank, a group of people who have served time and now are pushing for people like them to have a say in the city's efforts to help ex-offenders. On a recent morning, they and about a dozen others sat in a circle of fold-out chairs with Cecily Bradford Jones, RISE's new executive director, to tell her how her program can be better, something people want to take advantage of. Bradford Jones knows there's room for improvement.
This isn't the water department or the sewer department where there is a thing that you do. I'm looking at RISE as the people that we help.
After spending nearly two decades in prison on a robbery conviction, Colwyn landed a job with a program run out of the city's court system that seeks to break the cycle of recidivism. He says one way RISE can serve people better is by talking to inmates about the services available to them before they're released, especially when that day is in the distance, when it doesn't seem real yet.
Don't get me wrong, it's good to have those information boards around, but as a former state prison, I'm right past that. You know what I mean? I ain't trying to hear that.
And Colwyn says it's important for people who have sat in a jail cell to deliver that message.
Then at least people have a beacon of light at the end of the tunnel. You wouldn't be thrust back out into society.
Bradford Jones nods. It's one of the reforms she wants to make. Many are scribbled in one form or another on a big whiteboard inside her office above Spring Garden Street.
I haven't erased anything since last week. That's the scary part. I've only added things.
When it comes to jobs, Bradford Jones says she wants RISE to spend more time helping people get positions that feed their soul, not just their families, even if that can't happen right away. She says that could stop former inmates from returning to the streets, but also hopefully future generations from ever taking that path.
People do what they have to do for their families, but if we could tweak that and that mom and dad would then come home, tired as hell still, but at least they have a good story to tell about work or something that happened to them or some enjoyment in their day, that will go a long way in kind of building up the idea that work is okay. Work is all right. Work is actually pretty good sometimes.
Bradford Jones also wants to add more caseworkers to her staff, more people who can have a deeper, ongoing relationship with the people who come through RISE's doors. But Bradford Jones says it's on her office to make people want to come in. She says that all starts with the attitude her caseworkers, really everyone in the office, exude.
How I talk, how I act, how I sit, how I communicate with them is a reflection on them of how I feel about them. And if I'm slouching and don't care or popping gum or not giving you eye contact, you assume that I don't care.
And that would get in the way of helping. Life with a criminal past is often incredibly challenging and at times fragile. It's why keeping people from feeling discouraged is key. Aaron says RISE has to be a source of hope.
If it remains to be a shell, then that drives recidivism. You know what I mean? Like that drives people, not necessarily like myself, but that drives returning citizens to try to go down other avenues because you get frustrated.
The number of people who have taken advantage of RISE's services has declined. It's half what it was in 2014. If Cecily Bradford Jones can turn it around, her next worry will be having enough resources to help turn more lives around. I'm Aaron Mozell, WHYY News.
In advance of Saturday's start of the new America's Test Kitchen season on WHYY-TV, co-hosts Julia Collin Davison and Bridget Lancaster will be speaking tomorrow evening at WHYY. The topic? Favorite kitchen hacks and gadgets. It's based on their book entitled Kitchen Hacks, How Clever Cooks Get Things Done. Let's learn more with Julia Collin Davison. Julia, thanks for joining us on NewsWorks Tonight.
Oh, my pleasure, Dave.
What's a hack in this context?
So a hack is just a clever way to get things done using tools not particularly meant for the job or a shortcut. And so there's lots of hacks. I see sort of decorating hacks, office hacks. I just saw a thing this morning about phone car hacks to do with your, you know, the phone in your car. But kitchen hacks are obviously about cooking. And some of these are actually pretty clever, and I've started using at home when I cook. And it's sort of like, why didn't I think of that?
Tell us some obvious ones that come to mind.
Oh, the most obvious one, you have a cutting board on the counter and it's sliding around. Now, many of us know the quick way to prevent that from happening is you get either a clean rag or a piece of paper towel, and you get it wet. You slap it on the counter between the board and the counter, and that will prevent it from sliding around. Now, the second part to that is that I take either a used grocery bag or plastic, you know, produce bag, or even another towel or paper towel, and I put it on the far side of the cutting board. And that becomes the scrap area for all the bits and pieces that you no longer want on your board, so your board doesn't get all clogged up. So if you're trimming peas and you have the stem ends, you kind of slide them off the board completely onto that piece of plastic. And then you can easily gather them up and throw them away or put them in the compost. So that's one of my favorite all-time hacks that I use every day.
For listeners in need of an easier squeeze, what would you advise?
You know, the squeezing lemons is one of those things where juice can go all over. A lot of devices that are designed to help you squeeze juice, they don't really work. There is one tool well suited for it, but another thing you can do is use a pair of tongs. If you hold the tongs together and you sort of you use them as a reamer inside the lemon, it works very well and the juice doesn't go all over. So that's sort of my preferred juicing hack.
As people's tastes and habits evolve, how has the show kept pace, and what's in mind for the 2017 season?
At the end of the day, the show is largely the same. The same tasting segments with Jack, the same testing segments with Adam and Lisa. We're going to be demoing two recipes and explaining the science. So all that is the same, except it's Bridget and I sort of swapping in and out. Bridget and I will still cook, and we'll actually cook together, which we've never done before, and that's a lot of fun. And we also, I feel like we're pulling back the curtains a little bit to show what the test kitchen's really like. I mean, we have between 30 and 40 people cooking in that kitchen every day, and you don't really get to see them on the show. So our goal is to really show these people, show what they're doing, and really get a sense of the test kitchen. So that's the season coming up. And, you know, in terms of what we're cooking, I think we're cooking a lot more ethnic dishes, international dishes, learning our way around ingredients that are now available that weren't available 5-10 years ago. And every time, you know, a recipe calls for something new, like there's a Korean chili paste called gochujang, and we had a recipe that called for it this year, and I thought, people aren't going to be able to find this. And they said, no, you know, we have shoppers all over the country that go out and look for this. And they said it was widely available. And don't you know what? The next day I was at the supermarket and I reached right over a big sort of red box of gochujang. I thought, oh, this has been here all along. I've been reaching over it for months. And so what's available is just more diverse than it used to be. And learning how to use these ingredients is a little bit what we're focusing on, along with the standards of, you know, how do you really cook a steak and how do you really use a cast iron skillet. All that's in this upcoming season.
Julia, before I let you go, I have to have you weigh in on the chapter of most interest to me. It's 11th hour hacks. You made a mistake. Now let's fix it. I make nothing but mistakes in the kitchen. What are some obvious mistakes and fixes?
Yes. All right. So throw one at me. Give me an example.
Well, sometimes it's too late. I overcook the roast.
Oh, yeah. Then you make the sauce really, really good. The only key to an overcooked roast is making a really great sauce to go along with it and to go over and around it. You know, everybody makes mistakes. That's the first thing. One of the biggest mistakes people make, I think you hit on it, is the doneness of meat. It's not a hack, really. It's just advice, is get an instant read thermometer. And it is the biggest way to avoid overcooking meat is to temp it often and temp it early with a good thermometer. And so maybe the hack is print out the doneness chart of a meat and laminate it and put it on the inside of your cupboard door so that you can sort of avoid that in the future.
Can't wait to have you come to our studios tomorrow night. Julia, thanks for joining us on NewsWorks Tonight.
Yeah, thank you for having me. I look forward to tomorrow.
Julia Colin Davidson will be appearing with co-host Bridget Lancaster at WHYY tomorrow evening. Of course, that's all in advance of Saturday's start of the new America's Test Kitchen season on WHYY-TV. You can hear more of our conversation at newsworks.org.
You better come on in my kitchen. First part to be ready.
Finally this evening, the toy maker Hasbro is planning an update of its venerable board game Monopoly. The real-life streets of Atlantic City, from Mediterranean Baltic Avenues to the boardwalk, will still be there, though the tokens that players use as they make their way along those streets could be in for an update. Through the end of the month, fans can vote their choices for the 8 tokens used in the game. All of the current lineup are still in the running, but they've been joined by some modern-day icons, including an emoji, a hashtag, and a monster truck. And perhaps not surprising for an 80-year-old game, some of the choices seem a bit nostalgic, such as the Victrola and manual typewriter. It's not the first time Monopoly has evolved. The car, thimble, boot, top hat, and battleship are the original metal game pieces from 1937, while the Scotty dog and wheelbarrow were added in the early 1950s. Now note, the last time there was a change was 2013, that's when fans voted the cat token in, and causing another of the originals, the old-fashioned clothes iron, to be retired. Results of the vote will be revealed on March 19th, which, of course, is World Monopoly Day. That's all for tonight's show. NewsWorks Tonight is produced by Shai Benyakov, Kimberly Haas, Ty Johnson, and Brett Rader. The Pennsylvania Farm Show is in full swing this week in Harrisburg. Livestock and crops aren't the only perennials that appear there each year. And tomorrow evening, we'll look at how the farm show serves as prime politicking territory for Pennsylvania's state and federal lawmakers. Thanks for joining us. I'm Dave Heller for NewsWorks Tonight.